is Jared Ethan Black, Exodus Part 3, The Big Ten.
12 sons of Jacob, taken into with their families Egypt. By the time a generation turns, you've got 70 sons of Joseph remaining in Egypt, along with their families. The 70 sons of Joseph die. When they die, it signals a turn, a problematic turn, in that the Egyptians no longer remembered Joseph and his 70 sons, and they took this growing population and essentially, in all manner practically, enslaved them, made them workers for the kingdom of Egypt. And so they worked for hundreds of years until a baby born, wrapped in swaddling clothes and placed in an ark in the reeds, found by the Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter, raised in the Egyptian Pharaoh's courts until the age of 40. But not just raised as an Egyptian, raised with the nursemaid who just happened to be, by God's design, the baby's actual mother. Hebrew mother, a Hebrew mother who did what all great Hebrew mothers do. They passed on the heritage, the history, and the promise. And what was that heritage, history, and promise that baby Moses would have received for the 40 years of tutelage there in Pharaoh's court? It was simply this, that I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I have set aside a land flowing with milk and honey to you and your descendants. And you and your descendants will become more numerous than the sands on the seashore. That is the story. That is the kernel of promise that then explodes in the cosmos and creates a storyline that you and I can just now, in this day in our history, find ourselves a part. And so last week, we found our way winding out of the grip of the Egyptian army, the horses and the chariots round about us, following, hemming us in between the mountains and the sea. And Moses gets an instruction. It's the staff that he had at this burning bush experience years prior. It's that same staff. God seems to like it. And he says, stretch out your hand over the sea, and you will walk across dry land. Sure enough, he stretches his hand out. The miracle begins. The wind begins to blow. The sea begins to part, so much so that the description is two walls of water show up, and in the midst of the night, that squishy soil silt becomes dry enough to walk on, and walk on it they do. And as they walk and complete their journey, they are now out of Egypt, and the promise of God was this night, the Egyptians will never, ever, ever be your captors again. It's over. And as they turn to look, they see the chariots and the men being thrown and tossed about by the sea as it regains its position. The slaughter was great, and they stand, and what do? They do what happens, according to the Hebrews, 10 times in Scriptures, a song is birthed. It didn't just happen, it's birthed. The song of the Hebrews and the songs are powerful like that. A song actually has the capability to encapsulate a moment like really nothing else. There's something about melody and rhyme and meter. There's something about the act of singing and the act of formulating a revelation and then putting it to memory in song. And that's what happens here, the Song of Moses, as it's recalled. The Song of Moses is the song of liberation. And if you go deeper, it's the song that all people get to sing when they encounter this same God who spoke to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, the sons of Israel. That same God is meant to be for you and I. That's why this story is more than a story, a liberator. To take you from death to life, to move your life from slavery to freedom. But in that freedom, the lesson of this desert, Exodus teaches one thing. Well, it teaches lots of things. But one of the things Exodus teaches is that in total freedom, there is now required a total dependence on God. And it seems a bit counterintuitive that I am totally free to be totally dependent on God. And to the degree I'm no longer totally dependent, meaning I begin to rely on my own strength, my own horses, my own chariots, my own intellect, the day I do that, I begin to walk myself purposefully back into the enslaving shackles. And so God has created a cosmos, and He's created a people with one desire in mind, is that you would be my people and I would be your God. As you watch the story walk out in Exodus, Exodus is actually a pretty hard book because the God you're introduced to is culturally challenging. The God we're introduced to in Exodus is mighty, no doubt, is mighty to save, no doubt, but is also fairly particular. And we meet this fairly particular God through the eyes, the expression, and the very finger of God written on stone in a mountain experience, what happens right here. So the Hebrews leave Egypt for good, forever. They watch the emblems of their captivity, the chariots, the horses, the strength, the power, the might of Egypt, get swallowed up by the sea that they just walked across on dry land. And as they move forward, their first encounter, they just were rescued through the waters. Their first grumble and complaining when you read this story is they get to a place that has no water. And they, appropriately so, are freaking out. With this, we could have died in Egypt where the meat pots were full and the water was flowing. Why did we have to come here in the middle of nowhere to no longer get water and the clock is ticking? We're going to die. And so God brings them to a place of water. They move from one place to the next. And I do like this. This Hebrew storytelling is really masterful. Remember, it was 12 tribes and then 70 sons of Joseph. Well, they come to Elim, and there are 70 palms and 12 springs. Hebrew storytelling, the numbers in Hebrew storytelling are meant to connect you to all the places you've been before. This number 12 shows up throughout the entirety of the scriptures. And I want to set you up because when we look at the book of Revelation together, if you understand the imagery that's set up in Exodus, first time usage, what happens in Revelation is echoing, almost like an eternal reverberation of how God participates with us. And so here they are, 70 palm trees. Like it's an oasis, right? In the middle of this deserty, dead, dank area. If you get so bored over the next few weeks, go on YouTube. I just watched it last night. It really is fascinating. And unfortunately, it's in the church age of bad filmmaking and a bit of clip art accomplishment in storytelling. But there is this ongoing quest, and it was actually really quite big in the 80s and 90s. These amateur archaeologists would want to take the scriptures and they'd want to make a map and they'd want to go find what had yet been found or challenge the findings of a previous generation that didn't seem to make sense. The mountain that Moses goes to, the one that God calls them to, I'm going to take you to a mount of my choosing, he says, and there you will worship me. That's Moses' whole mission right now, is he's taking them here. And the journey so far has been harrowing. It has not been at all what he would have thought when he got the command at the bush. He's had to call down plagues. People have died. Cattle have died. Nation has been stripped of all of its vegetation. And here he goes wandering out, now with no water. All to find this place. 3 days, finally, they get there. They get to the mountain, Mount Sinai. This is a big debate. Where in the world is this Mount Sinai? There's a traditional site of Mount Catherine, which seems to have no bearing that anyone ever has ever been there for any length of time. No encampments, no circles, no rock formations, no nothing, no water, no evidence of there being any history of a large group of people here. Well, this little documentary, it's called Mountain of Fire. You should go look it up. about 40 minutes long, 44 minutes long. It was two amateur archaeologists, one ex-cop and another day trader. They get together and they get their maps out. I don't know, it was maybe the early 90s, possibly late 80s. And they find themselves with their maps and their sources, and you know, it's all paper back then. There's no Google Earth or anything to do. But they find themselves in Saudi Arabia, and they start mapping together where they think the Red Sea crossing is. They wind up coming to, in Saudi, a fence. It's chain link fence. It's an armored, guarded fence. And it has a sign on it that basically says, beware, do not cross. And the sign is written in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, which is odd to them. Why in the middle of the Saudi desert am I looking at a sign on a chain link fence with razor wire that says in English and in Arabic and in Hebrew the same warning? Like any good amateur archaeologist, they break the rules, they cut the fence, they go through. And they find on there what they would say were all of the signs, the symbols, the places that are referenced here. And there's pictures. And there's a little video of them looking at what then is the cave of Elijah. The telltale of all of this is what happens in Exodus 20. And this is where we're going to stop here today. Once God takes the people to the base of this mountain, he gives some very specific instructions. He says, I want you to create a perimeter. The people cannot come up on the mountain with you when I come in onto the mountain. Because if they do, I love the way it says it. It says that I might break out on them. Which is, I guess, divine code language for you're going to die. I don't know if it was a threat or a warning or just simply the reality of it all. Like, if you come on this mountain when I'm on this mountain, if I didn't call you on this mountain, you're going to have problems. And so these markers are set out, interestingly enough, in this Mountain of Fire video. There's 12 equidistant rings of rocks hewn together at 400 yards distance from one another, as if it's a barrier, a semicircle barrier around this part of the mountain where these folks perhaps were there. There's a really rough rock altar. You don't have to think too hard about it. And what's really fascinating about it is on the base of this altar are Egyptian hieroglyphs. How did Egyptian hieroglyphs, specifically pictographs of the Egyptian cow, get in the middle of the Saudi desert? They're all over it, the base of this thing. The inference might be that is this the very altar upon which that golden calf of Aaron was constructed and worshipped? I don't know. It's a pretty compelling visual. But probably the most compelling visual accompanies this. Moses, it says that when Moses goes on the mountain, the people watch in awe as the mountaintop is engulfed in smoke and flame. That's what it says in the entrance. Smoke and flame. And they are terrified. And it sounds like the voice of God begins to speak to them. And it's so terrifying to them that they cry out to Moses, don't ever let that God speak to us again. You speak to us on his behalf. And so Moses comes down this mountain, and there's a bit of a timeline issue here. Don't get lost in it. Just know that you can get lost in it. Is this the time when all the commands come down? Is this the time? Are there two separate mountaintop experiences? You and the rabbis can debate that for the rest of your life if you choose, but the result is the same. Moses comes down with two tablets, and these tablets are said to have been written by the finger of God, the commands of God, for how it is that a people of God should follow, worship, and obey this God for the surety of peace, that they may walk in righteousness, tzedakah, just like God established in a garden long ago. These two tablets of stone written by the finger of God are presented, they're spoken to the people, and it's what you guys would know of now as the Ten Commandments. Worth reading freshly? I'll just read them to you. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven or on the earth, beneath or in the water underneath it. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on their children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. But I show loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your sons, your daughters, your male, your female servants, your cattle, your sojourner who stays with you. For in the 6 days that God made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day, therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, his male or his female servants, or his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. All the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the smoking mountain. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. And they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself, and we will listen, but let not God speak to us, or we will die." And Moses says, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin." That mountaintop experience that occurs here is accompanied by thunder, lightning, fire, smoke, voices. I mean, just this, I mean, think about how terrifying that scene really could be. And yet in that, the result of is this, these words, these 10 words that supposedly orient all righteous living. And they are somewhat specific, but they do leave a lot of room for interpretation as well. In fact, when Moses comes off the mountain, as you read now further in Exodus, I'm just going to give you the storyline. There's about 10 chapters of explanation of how these particular commandments, these 10 laws, the Torah, the teaching of God, gets actually played out. I mean, what happens if you accidentally kill your neighbor? What happens if you accidentally hurt your neighbor's donkey? Or what happens if your neighbor's donkey eats part of your field? Or what happens if this or that? It's a lot of if-then statements that are that supposedly accompany God and Moses, their conversation on the mountain. You get the written law, which is the 10, the tablets, and then you get what is known as the oral law. It's that which was transmitted to Moses to interpret all the specific contextual situational differences that you and I will find ourselves in for all of our days. Nations find themselves in it, peoples, people groups. How do you relate properly with God, with each other, and with the earth? That harkens back to creation, does it not? The entire act of creation was creating righteousness, good. It is very good, God said. It all relates properly until it doesn't. Sin and fallenness enters, and now we find ourselves in a very singular storyline tracking with a particular group of individuals, people, now becoming a nation. You're watching them be born right here in this moment, just fresh from the Red Sea crossing, now at this mountain, is the ceremony. This is what God wanted to do with them. And it's so significant and monumental as the mountain itself bursts aflame and the words are spoken out of it. It is intended that they should never forget it. And although there's bits of history where it seems like it has been forgotten, history itself has been keen to remember it. As these two amateur archaeologists wind their way up the mountain, they do notice something very peculiar about this one specific peak. This large granite mountain, which is reddish, tannish in hue as they go up, very little vegetation, the top of it is in fact scorched. It's black. Quite unnatural and certainly distinct from any other mountain peak that's up there. And so as any good red-blooded American would do, they take the rock, not sure what it is because it doesn't quite feel like. They think maybe it's a pumice or lava, and they begin smashing rocks, which I think is awesome. And they smash the rocks open to discover that although the outside is sort of this silty, melted, black structure, the inside is in fact granite. It's a granite rock. It just happens to have been melted. And they can't get that image out of their head, and it's not even on fire. Imagine if it's on fire. Imagine if it is scorched. That mountain is known in Saudi Arabia as Jabal al-Lawz, and it sits sort of in the middle of the plains. Interesting documentary. You should check it out if that stuff interests you. It's compelling. So you get the 10, you get the commands, you get this righteousness edict of what it now looks like. And what's interesting about it is, yeah, it's the Ten Commandments, and they're written on these two tablets. It says both sides by the finger of God. And for years, I always had it in my mind that you had half of the commands written on one, and then, you know, the other half, because you just needed more room. Later study revealed that culturally, you probably had something else going on. A part of the oral instruction to Moses was the features of this mobile home that they were to build for God, this tabernacle, this mobile tent that was to accompany them through what turned out to be a 40-year excursion. And this mobile tent was to be the precursor for what ultimately Solomon builds, which is a fixed structure tabernacle with the Holy of Holies. But it still has the furniture of what they make in the desert. And they make the furniture for the tabernacle from the spoils that they took out of Egypt with them. Their slavery bought them incredible heritage. And Moses gets these pictures and these instructions of what to do with all this. One particular item, which is of note, corresponds with these tablets. They were made for it. It's a box, not quite 4 feet wide, about 3 feet tall. And it's actually kind of three boxes, an inner box of gold, an outer box, middle box of wood, and an outer box of gold. The whole thing is ensconced in gold with a cap on it, with a crown on it, and then these two cherubs meet in the middle, and their faces are looking at each other, but also down at the box, like the contents of the box matter. It's the Ark of the covenant, yes, but think about covenant as testimony. It's the Ark of the experience. And in this box, you read through the scriptures, not just in Exodus, but later, things get put in this box for safekeeping, but it's more than that. It's for continual remembrance. This box, this power box, it's actually, it's got quite a history. It was known to contain, as awkward as this sounds, the very power in presence of God. This box, this ark, was the very centerpiece of the sacrificial system yearly. It was what housed the mercy seat. It was what made the blood sacrifice ultimately connect with the heavenlies. I don't know much more than that, other than you could get yourself lost for an entire life about not only the history of this box, the rumors of the box, the myth and legends of the box. But the scripture does tell us what's in the box. And one of the things that's in the box are these two tablets. These two tablets are in the box. Now that sounds like, well, sure it is. You got, you know, five commands on one side, five on the other. You got to keep them together. You stick them in the box. There's something a bit deeper than this. And I want you to catch, because I think this, it illuminates something about God that remains mysterious to many of us. When you make a covenant, when you have a document, when you cut a contract, even today we do this, I get a copy and you get a copy. Your copy is to be kept forever because it spells out the nature of our contract. My copy is to be kept forever because it spells out the nature of our contract. So I take my copy. I don't want to lose it. I put it in a very special place, one that is sure not to be ruined. If your household takes that stuff seriously, you probably now, in a closet or under a bed somewhere, have a fireproof box where these valuables go, these insurance policies, or things that the paper upon which they're written and the words written upon that paper matter a lot because they spell out your rights and your opportunities. And so the other member of the contracting party would take their contract and they would put it in their most special place, safest place. That which, and you want both copies because you don't want someone to, you don't want there to just be one copy because someone could come in and change it. And then just say, well, this is the agreement we made. And if you don't have the accompanying copy, you have no recourse. Now, what I find interesting here is that this God, this fire-breathing, speaking, showing up, presence-oriented, burning a mountain, scorching but not consuming a bush, showing up to Abraham as this smoking, fiery oven and this burning torch, this God, who when he shows up physically, visibly on earth, always shows up in fire. This God makes a determination in his instruction. I want you to take the two tablets. And knowing what you know about contracts, what's written on these two tablets? Yeah, on each one. One copy is for the people. The other copy, ostensibly, is for who? For God. And so we want both people and God to put them in the very safest place possible. I do love this. The instruction's very clear. Take the two tablets, and you are to place them together in the box, the ark, as the ark of the testimony. God is a very risky character in the Bible. You'll learn that as you read. God's vulnerability is a part of what makes him so offensive. God is so certain in the power of the testimony that he is willing to risk, your safest place is my safest place. We will be joined together. In fact, when you start building out this New Testament concept, the entire reality, when Jesus and his disciples are sitting there, I in you and you in me, just as I am in the Father. I mean, this idea of what is God really after? God is after unity and oneness, not just between each other, but in an offensive, very mysterious, unclear way. The goal of all of this is that you and I together, along with everyone else, are summed up in Christ, who is in God. It's like if you believe in a big expanding universe, it's like there's a day coming where it just goes. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it was a fun noise to make. If that's what's happening, God takes his own contract, his own responsibilities, rights and responsibilities, our rights and responsibilities. We put them in the same box. That's going to be how it works between us. You will be my people. I will be your God. Where you go, I will go. And they journey on. The ten are pretty important. I mean, it's actually hard to dispel the ten. Outside of people wanting to argue about the religious rites of the Sabbath, it is hard to debate the others. Jesus, when asked about this, and in Judaism it developed, you know, there's all sorts of wonderful theologies and wonderful expositions and commentaries, but when you really get down to it, Jesus says, you know, it's fairly simple, and I say this to you sort of as the capstone of today. What happens on that mountain comes down to this, and it's so simple, it's profound. And it's so profound, it's simple. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and the prophets are summed up in these two. But those two are built from the ten. And the ten are explained in the culture, in the scriptures. But most importantly, they are explained in the way we, as the church, love one another. That is the means and methods by which God shows a world that we are His and He is ours. All from two tablets on a scorched mountaintop. All right, so you have a YouTube assignment. Yes. Go watch Mountain of Fires.
A student asked if we know where the Ark of the Covenant is today. I took a brief moment to respond.
Okay, I'm going to burn 2 minutes here. Not two exits down from exit 46, there is a very unappealing piece of property with trailers on it. And I would just tell you, we're in rumor land now, okay? There was a gentleman who actually is referenced in this little documentary that owns that, or did own it. Now his son owns it.
That land, not the Ark.
Not the Ark. But Ron Wyatt was his name. And his sons are still alive, and he used to take his sons on archaeological journeys. His sons were with him. I've talked to his son about this. His son's older than me, so there was a time their visa or whatever they had, their digging permit was running out, and Dad, Ron, was down in some of the antechambers because the Middle East is built on top of itself over generations. And so when you start digging down, you're not digging to rubble, you're digging to another person's house that got built over once it was destroyed or whatever. So these antechambers are quite well known. Ron claims to have burrowed his way into an antechamber, which made him pass out, possibly from lack of oxygen. But in that antechamber, he says he saw, drew, the Ark, the Table of Showbread, and the Sword of Goliath. And he was in Jeremiah's grotto. He drew it, and then he came out, and then they've never been able to go back. I asked his son, "Do you remember where you were?" He says, "I remember roughly where we were, but I don't know where Dad was under the ground because it was a labyrinth." And I said, "Well, why don't you go back?" Like, that's pretty compelling. It's been how many years now? It's been like 30 or 40. And he has a very interesting response. He said, "You know, if God wants us to do it, we will. But God has allowed it to remain hidden for so long, I don't know what the world would do with it anyway." It's a very interesting response. So I don't know where it is. The rumor, scripturally, is that Jeremiah hid everything in the temple because he knew, he was the prophet that was announcing the doom of the temple. He knew that the Assyrian, Babylonian kingdoms were going to ransack it and destroy it. And so the rumor is he hit it. But where he hit it, no one
knows. So many questions in my head, it's like a carousel spinning. Just when I think I'm at the end, I find I'm at the beginning. Well, if I had the chance to ask him, would I even know where to start? Yeah. Would I ask them chronologically right from the creation? Would I start with the finale, the book of Revelation? Maybe I should stop my thinking, let the questions flow from my heart.